ओम कीर्ति मिनंदस्य जलांगना सुलकया चक्षु स्मृतान्येन तस्मै श्री गुरवे नमः। श्री चैतन्य मनोविष्टं सुपीतं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपकमायां विदति सफलं पञ्चकपटुर्विभजेन्दुवैश्च प्रतिचरं प्रभुभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। Continuing the description by Narada Muni, Kumara Yudhisthira, of what household life is to be. Now, although these points that are going to be given are they're not directly bhakti or not directly devotion to Krishna, they are what we would consider sub-religious principles, religious principles that are below that, that lead one, that purify one, that cleanse the heart of the living entity so that he can easily or more easily develop bhakti, so he can reach the highest platform. And the first two principles that were discussed were actually very, very directly bhakti. One was that one shouldn't, when one is a householder, one shouldn't just make his consciousness very small and focused on his own family, and work and work and work just for his family. Why? It's natural to be focused on one's family, but it is natural only within a very small temporal context. Because for how long will we be in this body, and therefore how long will we have the connection with the family? We will be in this body, the particular body we happen to be in, for how long? We don't know. It could be tomorrow something may happen. Or if we live to ripe old age, it could be up to 100 years or maybe 103 years. But how long is that compared to eternity? So the basic principle of the Vedic culture, the Vanashrama culture, is that we are not the body. We are not to identify ourselves fully with our temporary situation. Yes, we have to act practically within that situation, but we don't think this is us and the totality of our existence. Yes, it's us in the sense that this is who we temporarily are, but this isn't us forever. And the great emphasis of the Vedic culture is to awaken the consciousness of who we are eternally, our natural, eternal relationship with God. So therefore, if we focus our consciousness, making our this body and all the accoutrements of the body the center of our existence as if it was us forever, then we are missing a great opportunity. Tadappa dhruvamartadam. A great opportunity to gain the greatest gain, which is to awaken our eternal relationship with Krishna. So first principle was not to just focus our consciousness on our temporary situation. And therefore, one should give one's wealth for spiritual purposes. Of course, one has to be practical. But one shouldn't, as the tendency always is for in household life, to focus one's the entirety of one's wealth upon the family needs, because those will always increase, and no matter how much money we have, even if we have billions of dollars, it won't be enough to satisfy all the desires that just blossom in twos and fours, and tens and twelves and hundreds, etc. So one has to be determined to, yes, be practical, take care of one's needs, but don't overdo it. Use whatever is required to keep one's body and soul together and live in a anxiety-free, as much as possible, comfortable fashion. But simple, simple life. Not the unnecessary necessities that Prabhupada described, just forever expanding. The wants, the desires, forever expanding. No remainder of one's wealth, if it's there, and the remainder of one's time shouldn't be exclusively used just to gain money and wealth. And if one has more wealth than one needs for the basics of a simple life, then one should use that for spiritual purposes. And the second principle was association of devotees. One should associate with those who are spiritually advanced, because by the grace of that association, what they have comes to us. That association is basically hearing Shastra. So now other principles are going to be discussed. Those principles were very directly devotional. Text 9. One should treat animals such as deer, camels, asses, monkeys, mice, snakes, birds, and flies exactly like one's own son. How little difference there actually is between children and these innocent animals. Here's Prabhupada's purport to this verse. Very interesting verse. One should treat animals like family members. Purport. One who is in Krishna consciousness understands there is no difference between the animals and the innocent children in one's home. Even in ordinary life, it is our practical experience that a household dog or cat is regarded on the same level as one's children. Without any envy. What does it mean, without any envy? The animals are regarded without envy. That means they're allowed to live. They have a life, a right to their own existence in life. Because if we see some ants or something, or some animals in our house, the natural tendency is, this is my house. What are you doing in my house? You're an intruder, and therefore we should kill you. This is tinged with envy, because the animal, again, has his right to existence. So household dog or cat is sometimes regarded on the same level as one's children without any envy. They have access into the house. Like children, the unintelligent animals are also sons of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And therefore, a Krishna-conscious person, even though a householder, should not discriminate between children and poor animals. Unfortunately, modern society has devised many means for killing animals in different forms of life. For example, in the agricultural fields, there may be many mice, flies, and other creatures that disturb production, and sometimes they are killed by pesticides. In this verse, however, such killing is forbidden. Every living entity should be nourished by the food given by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Human society should not consider itself the only enjoyer of the properties of God. Rather, men should understand that all the other animals also have a claim to God's property. In this verse, even the snake is mentioned, indicating that a householder should not be envious even of a snake. So very extreme. That all living entities have a right to live. Very, very ideal and wonderful. Even a snake. If everyone is fully satisfied by eating food that is a gift from the Lord, why should there be envy between one living being and another? So the envy in contemporary society is so great that those in our house, if they're well fed, that's good. But if the person next door is starving or dying, it's irrelevant. Who cares? As long as mine are well taken care of. So mine expands to my country. If there's a war and people are dying in another place, or they're killing each other, or one ethnic group hates another ethnic group, this is what it has expanded to, such envy. Because you have transgressed, you have something I don't have, possibly. Or I hate you. You have no right to exist, and therefore I shall kill you. So this mentality is, you are causing me some trouble or difficulty, therefore I will kill you. Inconvenience even, not only great difficulty, inconvenience. Therefore I shall kill you. You have no right to exist. So this is the attitude that causes people, human beings, so-called human beings, to kill. Kill others because of differences in religion, differences in race, differences in customs and habits, color, etc. What to speak of animals, killing animals, cows, other animals, human beings. And it has come to such a degree that they people will even kill the unborn children within the womb. So is this human civilization? That if you take birth, even though you are my child, if you take birth, it will be inconvenient for me in some way or another. And therefore, I'll kill you. And so that it's called something other than murder, they call it abortion. Because murder, if that now we're going to the murder clinic to take care of the unborn child, no one could tolerate that. So you give it a name. The birth is aborted. But what is it? It's aborted. That means that it's killed. The animal, the child is killed. If everyone is fully satisfied by eating food that is a gift from the Lord, why should there be envy between one living being and another? In modern days, people are very much inclined towards communistic ideas of society. But we do not think there can be any better communistic idea than that which is explained in this verse of Srimad Bhagavatam. Even in the communistic countries, the poor animals are killed without consideration, although they also should have the right to take their allotted food with which to live. So householders should be generous and open-hearted, not petty and compressed-hearted, liberal-hearted. Even if one is a householder rather than a brahmachari, a sannyasi or vanaprastha, one should not endeavor very hard for religiosity, economic development, or satisfaction of the senses. Even in household life, one should be satisfied to maintain body and soul together with whatever is available with minimum endeavor, according to place and time, by the grace of the Lord. One should not engage oneself in ugra karma. So in other words, one shouldn't become so caught up in materialistic endeavors that there is no time or energy for spiritual endeavor. Because spiritual endeavor is the actual purpose of life, of human life. So one should maintain one's body and soul and family, etc., and become satisfied in simple ways so that one's whole energy isn't spoiled on this level. We'll read the second half of Prabhupada's purport. These are the different occupational duties by which men should earn their livelihood. And in this way, human society should be simple. This is what was described a little earlier. At the present moment, however, everyone is engaged in technological advancement, which is described in Bhagavad Gita as ugra karma, extremely severe endeavor. This ugra karma is the cause of agitation within the human mind. Men are engaging in many sinful activities and becoming degraded by opening slaughterhouses, breweries, and cigarette factories, as well as nightclubs and other establishments for sense enjoyment. In this way, they are spoiling their lives. And all of these activities, of course, householders are involved. And therefore it is advised here with the use of the word api, that even though one is a householder, one should not engage himself in severe hardships. One's means of livelihood should be extremely simple. As for those who are not grihasthas, the brahmacharis, vanaprasthas, and sannyasis, the young students, the older, renounced personalities, and the fully detached mendicants, the sannyasis, as for these, they don't have to do anything but strive for advancement in spiritual life. This means that 3/4 of the entire population, the young and the elderly, should stop sense gratification and simply be engaged in the advancement of Krishna consciousness. Only 1/4 of the population should be grihastha, and that should be according to the laws of restricted sense gratification. The grihasthas, vanaprasthas, brahmacharis, and sannyasis should endeavor together with their total energy to become Krishna conscious. This type of civilization is called Daivi Vanashrama. One of the objectives of this Krishna consciousness movement is to establish this Daiva Vanashrama, but not to encourage so-called Vanashrama without scientifically organized endeavor by human society. So again, the basic principle is that life, human life, has its purpose, and it shouldn't be just frittered away on ephemeral enjoyments. It has its purpose, a very important purpose. To advance spiritually, to love Krishna, to live eternally, to develop that. That stays with us, even at the death of the body. But everything we gain on the material level, we must leave behind, including our families. Yes, our families, our wealth, our reputation. It's vanished. Our degrees. Finished with the death of the body. We leave them behind and take another body. But whatever spiritual advancement we've attained, we carry that to our next body, to our next breath. So therefore, the endeavor, in Vedic culture at least, is to accumulate spiritually, but not to be overly austere materially, but as simple as is practical for us. Not to make that the center of our life. The verses continue, text 11. Dogs, fallen persons, and untouchables, including chandals, dog eaters, should all be maintained with their proper necessities, which should be contributed by the householders. Even one's wife at home, with whom one is most intimately attached, should be offered for the reception of guests and people in general. The second half of Prabhupada's purport. The communists of the present day are in favor of supplying the necessities of life to everyone. But they consider only the human beings and not the lower animals. The Bhagavatam's principles are so broad, however, that it recommends that the necessities of life should be supplied to everyone, man or animal, regardless of good or bad qualities. The idea of giving one's wife to the service of the public is that one's intimate relationship with his wife, or one's excessive attachment for his wife, by which one thinks his wife to be his better half, or to be identical with himself, must gradually be given up. As formerly suggested, the idea of ownership, even of one's family, must be abandoned. The dream of material life is the cause of bondage in the cycle of birth and death, and therefore one should give up this dream. Consequently, in the human form of life, one's attachment for his wife should be given up, as suggested herein. What do you think of this, the first time you visit to the Hare Krishna temple? The principle, again, is based on the fact that we are eternal, that we have transferred. Even in this body, there is change of body. We have been young, we've been 3 years old, we've been 7 years old, we've been 12 years old, we've been 15 years old, 20 years old. Our body has changed, even in this life. And it will continue to change. And then, dehantara praptiya dhiras tatana muyate. that at the time of death, the soul transfers to another body. So if we place all our energy in physical, mental, emotional, if we invest everything into this current situation, which is temporary, we'll lose the opportunity that human life affords, and that is to awaken to our spiritual identity. Texts 12 and 13. One so seriously considers one's wife to be his own that he sometimes kills himself for her or kills others, including even his parents or a spiritual master or a teacher. Therefore, if one can give up his attachment to such a wife, he conquers the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is never conquered by anyone, by anyone. We'll read the next purport, the next verse, and then both purports. Through proper deliberation, one should give up attraction to his wife's body, because that body will ultimately be transformed into small insects, stool, or ashes. What is the value of this insignificant body? How much greater is the Supreme Being who is all-pervading like the sky? Prabhupada's purports to these verses. Every husband is too much attached to his wife. Therefore, to give up one's connection with his wife is extremely difficult. But if one can somehow or other give it up for the service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then the Lord Himself, although not able to be conquered by anyone, comes very much under the control of the devotee. And if the Lord is pleased with the devotee, what is there that is unobtainable? Why should one not give up his affection for his wife and children and take shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead? Where is the loss of anything material? Household life means attachment for one's wife, whereas sannyas means detachment from one's wife and attachment to Krishna. And then the next verse describes that the body that we become attached to, we become attached to the body of another. We don't actually recognize the life within that body. The person, the life force, the soul within that body, we don't even know. And that is the frustration in relationships. That it is limited to the bodily level, which isn't really the person. The person is so much more, so much deeper than this. Or at most, there is the mental level of the relationship, or the emotional level, but how about the soul, the actual person within there, within that body? So that body will ultimately, no matter how attached to it we are, no matter how much affection we have, that body of those who we are attached to, and even our own body, will die. And then what happens to it? In different cultures, different things happen to it. In some cultures, it's thrown and animals eat it. In some cultures, it's buried. And they, of course, they dress it up very nicely, so our remembrances are fond. But if you come back in 10 years and open up the box, the body is gone. All that remains is the skeleton. What happened to it? It's been eaten. So if we think of the body being given to animals, it's a horrific thought. But practically speaking, all we're doing is not thinking about what happens. We don't like to think about it because it's uncomfortable, but the body will get eaten. In some cultures, the body is burned, and then it turns into ashes. So if we have, if we focus the attachments on life to something that is temporary and it is bound to be turned into the stool of an animal or ashes, that is not considered intelligent. Better to have an attachment to the eternal part of that person. So therefore, so we can understand what our relationship is with our wife or our family members in this life, in the temporary situation. But what is our relationship in eternity? What is the relationship of the eternal soul, of those two eternal souls? That question we neglect. Here's Prabhupada's purport to text 13. Here also the same point is stressed. One should give up attachment for his wife, or in other words, for sex life. If one is intelligent, he can think of his wife's body as nothing but a lump of matter that will ultimately be transformed into small insects, stool, or ashes. In different societies, there are different ways of dealing with the human body at the time of the funeral ceremony. In some societies, the body is given to the vultures to be eaten, and therefore the body ultimately turns to vulture stool. Sometimes the body is merely abandoned, and in that case the body is consumed by small insects. In some societies, the body is immediately burned after death, and thus it becomes ashes. In any case, if one intelligently considers the constitution of the body and the soul beyond it, what is the value of the body? Antavanti imam deha nityasyokta saririnaha. The body may perish at any moment, but the soul is eternal. It is the soul that we actually love. It is the life within the body. Soon as the soul leaves the body, that which is lovable is no longer present. The remembrance is present of the one we loved. Why does everyone cry when a beloved leaves the body? Because something has left. What is that something? That was the real person. That was the life. That was the soul. And it's gone. Gone where? According to how one lives, one goes. So it takes a next birth. So this is the Vedic culture. That one should stress, one lives practically in the material world as is comfortable for one, but one should stress advancement in spiritual life. So if one gives up attachment for the body and increases his attachment for the spirit soul, his life is successful. It is merely a matter of deliberation. Because if we become attached to that which is doomed, then we are doomed to suffer, practically speaking, because we suffer when we're separated from that which we're attached to. So therefore, the Vedic culture teaches that we should build our attachment to the spiritual, to the eternal, and eternal relationship, and to Krishna, and minimize our attachments to the material, not just make it as if that was everything. Text 14. An intelligent person should be satisfied with eating prasad, food offered to the Lord, or with performing the five different kinds of jagya, pancha shunya, shunna. By such activities, one can give up attachment for the body and so-called proprietorship with reference to the body. When one is able to do this, he is firmly fixed in the position of a mahatma. Prabhupada's purport. Nature already has an arrangement to feed us. By the order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, there is an arrangement for eatables for every living entity within the 8,400,000 forms of life. Ego buhunam yo vidadattikaman. Every living entity has to eat something. And in fact, the necessities for his life have already been provided by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Lord has provided food for both the elephant and the ant. All living beings are living at the cost of the Supreme Lord, and therefore, one who is intelligent should not work very hard for material comforts. One shouldn't be lazy either. One should work hard, but the entirety of one's energy shouldn't be spent just on material comforts. Rather, Prabhupada continues, one should save his energy for advancing in Krishna consciousness. All created beings, all created things in the sky, in the air, on land, and in the sea, belong to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And every living being is provided with food. Therefore, one should not be very much anxious about economic development and unnecessarily waste time and energy with the risk of falling down in the cycle of birth and death. Every day, text 15, one should worship the Supreme Being who is situated in everyone's heart. And on this basis, one should separately worship the demigods, the saintly persons, ordinary human beings and living entities, one's forefathers, and oneself. In this way, one is able to worship the Supreme Being in the core of everyone's heart. When one is enriched with wealth and knowledge, which are under his full control, and by means of which he can perform jagya, sacrifice, or please the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one must perform sacrifices, offering oblations to the fire according to the directions of the Shastras. In this way, one should worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Purport. So again, there should be detachment on one side, and one should positively use one's life in the service of God. And the Hare Krishna Mahamantra basically means, "Oh Lord, oh energy of the Lord, please use me, please engage me in your service." This is actually the pleasure of the eternal soul, to be engaged in the service of the Lord, to be used, utilized by the Lord. So pleasurable, instrumental. Just like an artist. There are artists, and once one is an artist, there's a particular thrill to being an artist. What is that thrill? That you create something. And when one is in the creative moment, an energy, a creative energy, practically speaking, overtakes one. Greater than one's own ability. And it is so thrilling for the artist to be in the midst of that creative energy. This is why artists are the way they are. And they long for those creative experiences. Writers, they call it, for a writer, they call it being taken over by the muse. And then everything just happens. It's like all the words are in the pen and they just come out. So this is the thrill in art. So the thrill in devotion, or actually the thrill of the soul, is when the Lord's spiritual energy, His internal energy, Ladini Sambit Shakti it is called, His Antaranga Shakti, His internal energy, when the living entity takes shelter of that energy and Krishna uses us in His service. By nature we are tiny and we cannot exist independently like a spark of a fire. As soon as it's separated from the fire, it loses its fiery ability and tendency. It stops glowing. So similarly, we are tiny, even though we are spiritual and eternal. We are tiny. And we cannot exist without taking shelter of a greater energy. So either we take shelter of the illusory energy, Maya Shakti, the power of illusion, and we get enwrapped in illusion, thinking that yes, the situation I'm in is wonderful and it's eternal. Only I have to make this adjustment. It's never going to end. I can live like this forever, even though we see ourselves aging day by day. And we read in the newspapers how this person has transited. There's a transition. This person has gone. That person has gone. We see our friends, our grandparents, our great-great-parents have gone. But yet, in illusion, we never quite accept that our day will come. We live as if we will live forever. So there is truth in that, because we are eternal, actually. But there is no truth in what we're thinking about this. This is illusion. We've taken shelter of illusion, the Lord's illusory energy, Maya, is not that which is not. But we have to take shelter of some energy of the Lord. So we want the devotees, their prayer, their desire is to take shelter of the Lord's internal energy, not the illusory external energy, but the internal energy, which and be instrumental in the Lord's service. That is the natural position of the soul, and that is the eternal position. So sacrifice. A sacrifice means giving up what is dear to oneself, or one is attached to, for the pleasure of the Lord. Prabhupada's purport. If a grihastha or householder sufficiently educated in Vedic knowledge and has become sufficiently rich to offer worship to please the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he must perform yajñas as directed by the authorized scriptures. And the purpose of the yajñas or sacrifices is to please the Lord. So we'll read a little further down. The entire Vedic civilization aims at satisfying the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So there are so many rituals and activities, but the purpose is to please the Lord. This was possible in the Satya Yuga by meditation upon the Supreme Lord within the core of one's heart. And in Treta Yuga, a different time period, by the performance of costly sacrifices or rituals, yajñas. The same goal could be achieved in Dwapara Yuga, the pleasure of the Lord is that goal, by worship of the Lord in the temple. And in this age of Kali, the current age in which we live, one can achieve the same goal by performing Sankirtan Yajna, the congregational chanting of the Lord's holy names. Therefore, one who has education and wealth must use them to satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead by helping the Sankirtan movement that has already begun, a Hare Krishna movement or Krishna consciousness movement. All educated and wealthy persons must join this movement, since money and education are meant for the service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. If money and education are not engaged in the service of the Lord, these valuable assets must be engaged in the service of Maya, illusion. The education of so-called scientists, philosophers, and poets is now engaged in the service of Maya, and the wealth of the rich is also engaged in Maya's service. The service of Maya, however, creates a chaotic condition in the world. We don't see that people have become happy or satisfied or free from anxiety by the advancement of materialistic civilization. Therefore, the wealthy man and the educated man should sacrifice their knowledge and opulence by dedicating them for the satisfaction of the Supreme Lord and joining the Sankirtan movement. Yajyai Sankirtana Prayar Yajanti Hi. Text 17. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, is the enjoyer of sacrificial offerings. Yet although his lordship eats the oblations offered in the fire, my dear king, Narada Muni is speaking to Yudhisthira Maharaj, he is still more satisfied when nice food made of grains and ghee is offered to him through the mouths of qualified Brahmins. Prabhupada's purport. Two sections of it, or maybe one. Two. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, yajna tat kamanonyatra lokoyam kamabandana. All fruit of activities should be performed for sacrifice, which should be directed toward pleasing Krishna. As stated elsewhere in Bhagavad Gita 5:29, Bhoktaram Jagatapasam Savalokamaheshram. He is the Supreme Lord and enjoyer of everything. However, although sacrifice may be offered to please Krishna, he is more pleased when grains and ghee, instead of being offered in the fire, are prepared as prasad and distributed, first to the Brahmins, then to others. This system pleases Krishna more than anything else. And then a little bit further in Prabhupada's purport. Under the circumstances, the Shastras enjoin yajñai sankirtana prayer yajanti hi sumedasa. In this age, those who are intelligent offer yajña or perform sacrifices through the Sankirtan movement. Everyone should join the Sankirtan movement, offering to the fire of this movement the oblations of his knowledge and riches. In our Sankirtan movement, or Hare Krishna movement, we offer sumptuous prasad to the deity and later distribute the same prasad to the brahmanas, the Vaishnavas, and then to the people in general. Krishna's prasad is offered to the brahmins and Vaishnavas, and the prasad of the brahmins and Vaishnavas is offered to the general populace. This kind of sacrifice, chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra and distribution of prasad, is the most perfect and bona fide way of offering sacrifice for the pleasure of yajña, or Vishnu. Text 18. Therefore, my king, first offer prasad, my dear king, first offer prasad unto the brahmanas and the demigods, and after sumptuously feeding them, you may distribute prasad to other living entities according to your ability. In this way, you will be able to worship all living entities, or in other words, the supreme living entity within every living entity. Purport.
To distribute prasad to all living entities, the process is that we must first offer prasad to the Brahmins and the Vaishnavas, for the demigods are represented by the Brahmanas. In this way, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is situated in everyone's heart, will be worshipped. This is the Vedic system of offering prasad. Whenever there is a ceremony for distribution of prasad, the prasad is offered first to the Brahmins, then to the children and old men, then to the women, then to the animals, like dogs and other domestic animals. When it is said that Narayan, the Supreme Being, is situated in everyone's heart, this does not mean that everyone has become Narayan, or God, or that a particular poor man has become Narayan. Such a conclusion is rejected herein. Text 19. A Brahmana who is sufficiently rich must offer oblations to the forefathers during the dark moon fortnight in the later parts of the month of Vajra. Similarly, he should offer oblations to the relatives of the forefathers during the Mahalaya ceremonies in the month of Ashvin. See, these are all ritualistic points. One should perform the Shraddha ceremony on the Makara Sankranti day, the day when the sun begins to move to the north, or on the Karkata Sankranti, the day when the sun begins to move south. One should also perform this ceremony on the Mesha Sankranti day and the Tula Sankranti day and the yoga named Vyatipata, on that day in which three lunar titis are conjoined during an eclipse of either the moon or the sun, or the 12th lunar day, and in the Shravan Nakshatra. So these are the times that one should pay one's respects to one's forefathers and one's deceased forefathers, different astronomical times. One should perform this ceremony on the Akshaya Tritiya day, on the ninth lunar day, the Nomi, or on the bright fortnight of the month of Kartik, on the four Astikas in the winter season, Astakas, and the cool season, on the seventh lunar day of the bright fortnight of the month of Magh, during the conjunction of Magha Nakshatra, constellation of stars, and on the full moon day, and on the days when the moon is completely full or not completely full, when these days are conjoined with the Nakshatra, the constellation from which the names of certain months are derived, one should also perform the Shraddha ceremony on the 12th lunar day, when it is in conjunction with any of the Nakshatras named Anuradha, Shravan, Uttara Falguni, Uttara Sadha, Uttara Bhadrapad. Again, one should perform this ceremony when the 11th lunar day is in conjunction, I see, Ekadasi, with either Uttala Falguni, Uttara Shada, Uttara Bhadrapad. Finally, one should perform this ceremony on days conjoined with one's own birth star, Janma Nakshatra, or with the Shravan Nakshatra. So, these are rituals that householders should perform, and one of the ritualistic activities a householder must perform is in relationship, the Shraddha ceremony in relationship to one's forefathers, because one owes them debts, because one has taken birth in their family and has the opulences of that family. So that path isn't exactly for devotees. That's for those who are fruitive workers, or who are following that section of the scriptures, and some more on that level. All of these seasonal times are considered extremely auspicious for humanity. At such times, one should perform all auspicious activities, for by such activities a human being attains success in its short duration of life. During these periods of seasonal changes, if one bathes in the Ganges, in the Jamuna, or another sacred place, if one chants, offers fire sacrifice, or executes vows, or if one worships the Supreme Lord, the Brahmanas, the forefathers, the demigods, the living entities in general, whatever he gives in charity yields a permanently beneficial result. O King Yudhisthira, at the time prescribed for reformatory ritualistic ceremonies for oneself, one's wife, or one's children, or during funeral ceremonies and annual death ceremonies, one must perform the auspicious ceremonies mentioned above in order to flourish in fruit of activities. So we'll read these last two short purports from 24 and 26, and then we'll stop. But the idea is that even the one's life shouldn't be simply restricted to selfishness. Even if one can't be a great, great devotee and give up everything in the service of the Lord and live very simply, at least one should minimize one's selfishness and be charitable, at least to one's own family members, at least to the forefathers. That's the idea. And by acknowledging that a ceremony that you perform now will auspiciously affect a forefather who's passed from his body years ago, one is also developing a consciousness of the eternality of the soul. Oneself is benefited by developing that consciousness. And one's heart expands a little bit, because that contraction of the heart, where one feels more and more that I have less and less and less and need more and more, and that just causes greater and greater contraction and greater selfishness, which causes greatest dissatisfaction. One has to open one's heart, and the tendency in householder life is to contract one's heart. So the Vedic culture gave provisions for those who were exalted spiritually. Even if they were married, they could be exalted spiritually and detached from the externals of their family situation and dutifully perform everything. Who were exalted and realized those personalities fit in the Vedic culture and had their own duties, and as well as those who tended greatly to being selfish, they had simple ways that they could expand their consciousness. And basically, again, there was charity, and there was hearing from personages, holy personages, hearing Shastra. These were the basis. And then, according to who one was, what one's abilities and consciousness and what one's realizations were and thoughts about life, one could proceed. But everyone would make advancement, even a little bit. And in that way, one's life wasn't wasted from the spiritual point of view. If one makes a little bit of advancement in spiritual life towards the eternal, that advancement, that progress is also eternal. But if, on the other hand, if one's life is focused simply on the mundane, the temporary, the materialistic, whatever one gains, no matter how great it is left behind at the death of the body. So this is the Vedic culture, to teach that one must put energy at least to make some advancement in the spiritual. So we'll read those two purports. Now again, this spoke about the ritualistic side of different ceremonies, but these aren't exactly for devotees. They're for people who need to make little progress, not the ultimate progress. Prabhupada's purport. And we'll read both these purports. When one comes to the human form of life through natural evolution, one must then take the responsibility for further progress. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, Yanti Deva Vrata Devan, one who worships the demigods can be promoted to their planets. Yanti Mad Yajino Pimam, and if one practices devotional service to the Lord, he goes back home, back to Godhead. In the human form of life, therefore, one is meant to act auspiciously in order to return home back to Godhead. Devotional service, however, does not depend on material conditions, this time or that time. That last verse spoke about the different times. The verses before that spoke about auspicious activities, and then this was auspicious times to perform the auspicious activities. But devotional service is not dependent on auspiciousness of time and, or as later on we'll hear, of place even. Ahaitiki apachiyata does not depend on any material condition, because our relationship with God is ever-present and eternal. Of course, for those who are engaged in fruitive activities on the material platform, the times and seasons mentioned above are extremely congenial. The Vedas recommend, this is the last purport we'll read, short, text 26, many ritualistic ceremonies to be performed with one's wife, on the birthdays of one's children or during funeral ceremonies. And there are also personal reformatory methods like initiation. These are called sanskaras, because these ceremonies, like the marriage ceremony, they make impressions in the consciousness, which are very important for civilized, to live a civilized life. These must be observed according to time and circumstances and the direction of the shastras. Bhagavad Gita strongly recommends gyatva shastra vidanoktam. Everything must be performed as indicated in the shastras. For Kali Yuga, the shastras, the scriptures enjoin that Sankirtan Jagya be performed always. Sankirtana Sada Hari. All the ritualistic ceremonies recommended in the shastras must be preceded and followed by Sankirtan, the chanting of Krishna's names. This is the recommendation of Srila Jiva Goswami. Okay. Thank you very much. You've been very patient. Thank you. Hare Krishna. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Tomorrow, Krishna willing, finish chapter 14.